Hi, this is John Udell. Today's podcast is a conversation with Marty Collins. She's Senior Marketing Manager in the Solution Architecture Group, responsible for a chunk of the architectural guidance that's available on MSDN, as well as the community site skyscraper.net. Marty wanted to ask me about blogs and technical marketing, and I wound up asking her about an interesting initiative that she's putting together as well. So there's some question here as to who's interviewing who.
Right, exactly.
I suppose we're interviewing each other. And
I guess so.
I think that's fine.
Okay.
People will know roughly who I am, but you should introduce yourself.
All right. So my name is Marty Collins, and I work in the evangelism group here at Microsoft. My specific audience that I am interested in is the architect, the software architect. I'm responsible for how the architect audience feels about Microsoft, and how we supply content and how we answer the needs of what architects are going to be confronted with in the near future. And so we are interested in software as a service, anything that would be of a concern to an enterprise architect.
Okay. And how is that interest manifested? In other words, what do you do?
Marketing. So I'm a marketing person for that team.
Mm-hmm.
I devise the channels that we're going to deliver that content through, and I open up avenues to get feedback from architects. We work with our evangelists around the world to get feedback from them. If we're talking about the right stuff, how are we getting them our content? How are we making it consumable and interesting? And are we hitting on all cylinders?
And what is your definition of content?
Content to us is guidance. Mostly guidance. So we're not a product-focused team, obviously, from the evangelism group.
Mm-hmm.
So we offer guidance and solutions.
So if I'm one of these architect types, I will find your guidance and solutions where?
MSDN, WAC Architecture, is our main site of all where all of our library content is.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have a community site to learn about architecture that would be interesting for either a pro developer or a solutions architect, possibly. And that website is called Skyscraper.
Okay.
And Skyscraper is a community server website that has bloggers and has a glossary of terms and kind of a really great place just to sort of learn what architecture is. MSDN is more higher level, obviously has some base level knowledge of architecture needed to consume most of that content.
Okay. So, for example, the written output of some of the Microsoft folks who are in the patterns and practices area, that would show up somewhere under this umbrella?
Patterns and Practices is another group that talks to architects as well. And I know that they have a site on MSDN.
Oh, okay, but that's not you.
Not us, right.
But there are obviously relationships between that stuff and your stuff, so how do you manage those relationships?
They are interested in one type of architecture, whereas we're more global in the sense of we're interested in infrastructure and we're interested in industry architecture and business architecture, so we're more broad in the sense of what we look at architecture to be,
mm-hmm.
whereas Patterns and Practices is focused on solution architecture. But there's a ton of overlap. They put out really great books and guidance, and we share back and forth resources as well. They're really involved in the MVP program, working with our MVPs, and they do some really interesting summits, and they have a really good engine of kind of churning along of how they get their books out to their community as well.
Okay.
So that's what I do. So why don't you tell me a little bit about your history? I know you're new to Microsoft. So maybe you could tell me where you came from, how long you've been blogging.
When people ask me to date the moment when I began blogging, I say 1996.
1996.
No, there weren't blogs in 1996.
So what were you?
But I was involved in a way of using the internet that felt then to me very much the same as the practice of blogging feels now.
Okay.
The particular manifestation of it back then was that I was at Byte Magazine, where I was the executive editor and I ran the new media stuff, and so built out the Byte website, built out a set of, at the time, NNTP newsgroups or forums that were used by us at a variety of scopes, ranging from my own small development team to our editorial group at large to, in fact, the whole company, to a global scope where we had public news groups. And it was in the context of all of that stuff that I really, for the first time, got clear about what this process could be like of doing what, years later, Dave Weiner described as narrating your work. And I think that's a fabulous and evocative term, and I use it a lot. The process of narrating your work is what I think a lot of this comes down to.
That is really interesting, actually, to think about it like that. I always just thought about, finally, I started blogging because I had all these thoughts in my head. It seemed like a way to get them out of my head.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah. So when you started That's interesting. So you started blogging in 96 in somewhat of a different form than it is now. What were your goals then? And I guess how have they evolved to, you know, here we are 11 years later?
They remained very much the same. So the goal at the time was to publish as much as I could and as effectively as I could my own public agenda. So at the time, I was working for a magazine and my public agenda was, well, it changed actually, because the epiphany for me was a moment when I was working on a cover story for Byte Magazine. And up until that time, the method had been very much one where we would keep secret, really, what it was that we were working on. And, you know, we would kind of spring this cover story on the world and everyone would read it, and then the reactions would come in afterward. But the notion was not at all that we would share part of our process up front. That's what changed right there and then for me, and it changed all at once very dramatically, because I saw that in this particular case, there was nothing necessarily confidential about the fact that we were doing a cover story on, you know, whatever the topic would have been, I forget. On the other hand, there was the possibility that if I could engage the people who would be reading that article sooner, in fact, before it was written, then I could produce a better article. So, for example, at the time we were doing these very heavily researched cover stories, they're almost New Yorker style in a way, and they would run quite long, you know, 5,000, 6,000, 8,000 words, and would be heavily researched and reported. And I was spending an enormous amount of time trying to find people to talk to, because we were working in areas where it wasn't obvious who were the people that had the knowledge, really, about this stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I had the idea that I could, on my news group, where I had an ongoing conversation with a lot of people, I could say, look, you know, here's kind of the outline for the story. This is where I'm going with it. What do you guys think about this? What's missing? Who do you think I should talk to that I don't know that I should talk to? In other words, trying to figure out ahead of time the stuff that otherwise, historically, had come to us after the fact. You know, the thing's printed and it's out there on the newsstands, and then people start writing in and complaining, well, geez, you know, you didn't know about this, that, and the other. How could you, you know, possibly claim to have been writing a comprehensive article on this topic?
Right.
This early exposure of my outline worked incredibly well. One of the things that popped up was a person at JPL, the Jet Propulsion Lab, who was doing exactly the kind of work that I wanted to find out about. And he popped up on my newsgroup and we had a certain amount of conversation there. And then we took it offline and I interviewed him. And that became kind of the centerpiece of the story. It just dawned on me after that was all done how amazing that was, because I never would have found the guy working as a conventional reporter. You know, what would you do, right? You know, kind of call up random large organizations and talk to the PR people and say, who in your company is doing something interesting with distributed data visualization?
Right.
And I did, actually. There were weeks when I spent more time on the telephone than our salespeople did.
Right.
Doing exactly that kind of thing. But it was incredibly inefficient. And here,
right.
this guy, he found me.
Right.
It was just an extraordinary moment.
Right.
I think that fundamental insight still hasn't been fully absorbed by a lot of people, maybe even me. A lot of what has been going on in the last 10 years is just kind of letting the implications of that sink in, because it's pretty profound. And,
right.
You know, so you have to now generalize this beyond the specifics of somebody who's in journalism, somebody who's working on an article for a magazine, how this principle applies more broadly across various kinds of professions and in various businesses is quite interesting, but I'm convinced that it does.
That's very interesting. That's a really interesting way to think about it. I think you're exactly right. And I guess it'll continue to evolve. So like you said, it's been 10 years. It'll be interesting to see how that does get absorbed into how people think about where they get their information. And is it ever complete? I feel like nothing is ever exactly complete anymore. Like, you take Wiki, right, or Wikipedia. Nothing ever seems exactly done anymore. It doesn't get printed and bound like encyclopedias used to do, and you'd put it on your shelf and kind of walk away.
Right.
Seems like that whole mindset is different now.
Yep. Yeah. Process versus product. I mean, there's still, so to continue with the magazine analogy,
yeah,
there still is a product,
yep,
but it's now embedded in this process that has a long upstream and a long downstream. So there's this process that precedes the creation of the product, which is visible online and involves interaction. And then there's this tail after it's published, and there's a whole process there too. And the product itself is just a moment in that process that is especially well baked.
Right. So I saw that you answered very well in your blog your decision on why to come to Microsoft. Maybe you could just quickly, for people who haven't seen that posting, explain what made you come to Microsoft and how do you anticipate your blogging style to now change?
The dominant factor for me was scale. the context for that is that I've been, for quite a while now, talking to a pretty elite audience of technologists. In the last couple of years, I've felt increasingly that it's necessary to connect out much more broadly, because Microsoft or not, I just think in general that the tech biz is not really connecting to regular people in their real lives, in their real businesses, in their real work, in their real families. That's the fundamental motivation. I sort of stepped back and said, there's hundreds of millions of people who are so not on the same page as we geeks in the ivory geek tower. Mm-hmm. What's an organization that reaches that number of people? And Microsoft is such an organization.
Right. So do you think your blogging style will change?
The style that I use now is well suited for a particular audience of elite technologists, and so I don't plan to change that. Mm-hmm. What I hope to do and am struggling with how to do is open up some kind of a separate channel. I don't exactly know what that will be. That is readable by my sister, your mom,
right,
someone else's brother-in-law.
Right.
There are a bunch of topics that are both critically important to me and critically important to everyone. Mm-hmm. But so far, the context in which I've talked about those things is only accessible to pretty technical people. Mm-hmm. And so one of my goals is to find another way to communicate. I've had some clues about how to do that just recently. So, for example, I live in New Hampshire, and I've formed a relationship with New Hampshire Public Radio, and I've done a series of short commentaries there on issues at the intersection of technology and society, where I replay some of the themes that I've been writing about to my technical audience for a long time, but in a way that will make sense to regular folks.
Right.
I've had some success there. There are definitely connections that have been made to people who never have read my InfoWorld blog, would never read the current incarnation of my blog.
Right.
That's one indication of me learning to be a little smarter about multiplying the channels that I use, and differentiating them.
So that's interesting you say that. Skyscraper, the community site that I spoke of, when we were brainstorming as to what that would be and thinking about the positioning of it and what would the brand stand for and all the stuff you do in the beginning phases of bringing a product to market as a marketing person, that actually was one of the goals of the page, of the community site, I would ask the architects when they would write something for the site, I would say, you know, is this something, like you said, that your wife is going to read? Is this something that your mother's going to be able to understand? And not that obviously your mother is at all less intelligent, but are you using words that, for lack of a better word, a layman would understand without having 15 years of experience behind those words? And it's been really powerful to be able to say to people, go look at this site, and this site will really explain it to you in everyday terms that myself as a marketer or a doctor or a teacher or anybody else can understand without having 15 years of experience, which is exactly what you're talking about.
Although, is architectural guidance for your audience the kind of thing that ever should or will appeal to a mainstream audience?
Well, an example would be certainly not at a detailed level, certainly not the stuff that we have on MSDN where you'd read a 25-page white paper. No, that's not going to appeal. But I think what people are interested in is when they see Bill Gates' title, up until obviously when he gave the notice that he was going to move on, his title is Chief Software Architect for Microsoft.
Mm-hmm.
And millions of people had no idea what that means. What does that mean?
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's the chief software architect. Not a clue as to what that means.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the more context you give to what that means, and because he's obviously such a well-known figure, it makes it more clear for people that I know, that we talk to every day, that the architects talk to every day. When our architects talk to people that are developers or people that are at Boeing or, you know, whoever our customer is, it makes it easy for them to understand what we do. So maybe not a consumer in the sense of somebody that's buying an iPod. No, maybe they'll never care about architecture. But a large majority of business people, so BDMs and such, they will care about architecture. They do care about architecture.
You got to spell out BDM.
Oh, BDM, business decision maker. Pardon me.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. So, if you're senior VP of Bank of America and you're interested in what your total cost of ownership is for a technology, you're going to be interested in how the architecture works with your system, because it's going to, in the end, lead to your bottom line.
So this is actually a really interesting point, because, as you know, the entire software industry is engaged in this process of trying to figure out how to bridge the chasm that separates the IT folk from the business folk.
Totally, right.
to the extent that architects are narrating their work in a variety of ways, one of those ways being an effort to explain what they do and how they do it to their business clients, that's a good thing. An interesting question to me here is, what's the relationship then between the stuff that you would produce for an audience of architects versus the stuff that they might produce for their clientele?
What we produce is guidance of what the architects would use in their business and how they're developing their systems.
Mm-hmm.
What they would use would be a combination of where they're getting all their information. So they may take something from Microsoft. They may take something different from IBM. It's up to the architect to go out and find as much as they need to know what the systems they're already using in their company are, and then sort through that guidance and bring it back to their stakeholders.
Now, to what extent do you think that the bringing it back to their stakeholders is a process that winds up being manifested as they write their own blogs, either internally to the company or publicly?
That's interesting. It's interesting because, to some degree, and I might get in trouble for this statement, architecture is one of those, it's exactly what you were talking about like 10 minutes ago when you said, you know, it never occurred to you back in the 90s that you would go and ask anybody for help before you wrote the article, because your currency, right, your product was this article at the end, so you weren't going to go and share with people before you were writing it what it was. So there is an old mindset of architecture. It's part of their differentiator, right? It's part of their competitive advantage in a company. When you're talking about the size of Boeing or Microsoft, Microsoft isn't going to share to the world how it architecturally sets up its systems, because if they're having some major cost-saving measure or some sort of differentiator hidden in there, that's a competitive advantage.
Mm-hmm.
To date, companies don't share competitive advantages, and that's completely logical. There's an interesting place between those two things. There's a place between nobody expects you to share your competitive advantage. That's logical to anybody to understand that you wouldn't do that. But there is a place in blogs, like what you just said, and there are architects on our team that blog. We give away our solutions for free. That's what we do as an evangelism group, which is what's fascinating about working in this evangelism group. We give away our guidance for free in the hopes and understanding that you'll read it and you'll say, wow, maybe Microsoft knows what they're talking about this.
So when you say there are architects on our team that blog, you mean ones who are employed by Microsoft?
Yes, on the architecture strategy team that I work on, in the evangelism group, DPE, we have about 18 or 20 architects.
Mm-hmm.
So this group is two marketing people, myself and somebody else, and the rest are all true architects. They were architects doing whatever they were doing before they came to this team. Now they're evangelists that talk about architecture.
Mm-hmm.
And probably about half of those blog on a regular basis.
What connections do you see between those folks and the ones who are outside of Microsoft in the trenches being architects? Some, maybe not a whole lot, but some of those folks also write publicly.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they do. Yeah. They write publicly. You know, our architects read their blogs and take guidance because we pass them around. Like, you know, we'll do email strings about particular bloggers. Obviously, there are some that are more influential than others.
Mm-hmm.
And we look at their stuff all the time. We talk about it and we say, oh, you know, are we on track with this? Is this guy all wet? What do we think about this? It continues to provoke conversation with us that if the bloggers weren't doing that, I'm hard-pressed to figure out how we'd be having those conversations on a regular basis.
Exactly.
Which is so right, which is exactly where you're leading.
Exactly.
Exactly right. Yeah. Very true. Okay, let's talk about, this is what's really interesting to me and kind of how I came to want to chat with you about this is, so, you know, Microsoft is just one company that's diving into the blogging space and using it as an information source for our customers. And what is unclear at this point is how bloggers can be used as, and I don't really like to use the word marketing, I'm trying to think of a better word here. But I'm trying to think of a better word than that. But
good luck.
I know. So let's see. What we really want to do in all good intention and in complete transparency is pass our message along the easiest way to where people are talking. And in all my research and everything I look at now is people are talking in the blogosphere. They're chatting, they're talking, they're making decisions, they're influencing people. So how does somebody, a marketer, get to be a part of that conversation without at all diluting that conversation or at all making it seem less than good intentions of which it is?
I'm going to give you an answer that you won't like,
okay.
But I'll give it to you anyway because I think it's a great answer. Well, it's not really a solution for you, but it is an answer to this question, and I think it's an important one.
Okay.
Among other things, I've been on a screencasting kick. I'm really interested in making kind of movies of software on screen with narration about what's going on. Mm-hmm. That's a really powerful way of explaining software to people. A couple years ago, a friend of mine, his name is Paul Everett, and he was with the Zope Corporation. Now he's with Zope Europe. He, on his blog, answered the question a friend of his had asked him, and the question was, what is it like to use this particular XML editor? I forget even what the product was. And Paul sat down and he started to write something up about his experience of using this tool. And he said, oh, wait a minute, you know, John's been on about this screencasting thing. Why don't I, and I've been meaning to try that, why don't I just do that? So he got a hold of a screen recorder and he fired it up and he made this little sort of 5-minute thing that was him walking through how he uses the tool. In the course of doing that, he was extremely candid and it was 100% authentic. By that, I mean that he said, look, here are the parts that I use and here are some things that I really like. Now, this particular thing right here, to be honest, this other tool does it better, but on balance, this is the one that I use. And so obviously I'm using it because on balance, it's got the combination of features at the price that is right for me. This is kind of an amazing thing if you think about it, because if you went to the products page on this company's website, you would see the classic thing, right? Features and benefits, sort of a static presentation. Maybe, in this case it wasn't true, but maybe there might have been a marketing screencast, you know, but the marketing screencast would have been very highly produced, very slick. It would have been an ad, right?
Yeah.
This wasn't an ad.
Right.
This was a personal testimonial. And Paul just did it because he was interested in sharing his experience of the product with other people. And so, you know, I looked at that and went, wow, I mean, that's marketing you can't buy.
Right. That's word of mouth.
I think that, you know, just personally, I mean, yeah. I'm not a marketer, right? I'm not in your profession.
Right.
But I think that that's where things will go and should go.
Yes, I agree. And I think that's why I hesitate to use the word marketing, because I think about it in terms of more of customer service. That way you just described is customer service in the sense that it's giving somebody a better solution to a problem. So if you think about Dell, because I know Dell is trying to do this and getting away from Microsoft for a minute. Dell wants to be able to go out into the forums, not just blogs, but, you know, where the chatter is happening, forums, community sites, wherever,
mm-hmm.
and be able to answer people's questions about their products in a customer service way. They can, it's being run through the marketing org, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the idea of it is customer service. So if John has a problem with his Dell and, I don't know, the screen doesn't work or something,
right?
And he is posting on some forum or blogging, maybe on his blog. Obviously, everybody knows the Jeff Jarvis story about Dell, but let's stick with John. John's blogging on his blog about, my screen doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
Does anybody know what to do about this? Dell wants to be able to, and could arguably make sense, that they should be hearing that chatter and be able to pipe in on that conversation and respond on John's blog and say, hey, John, this is Dell, total transparency. You know, we are Dell, and we'd love to be able to solve that solution for you. You know, bam, here's whatever, the link that solves the question that you were looking for.
That would be awesome.
Yeah. So that would be great, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's what I think marketing should do. So that's my thinking about using marketing in the blogosphere, that kind of a scenario. What you described about creating the pretty screenshot and dropping it in, I think that absolutely would reek of marketing. And it wouldn't stay in the flow of what a forum or blog was meant to do.
Right. There's two different threads here that we should pull apart. So
yeah.
There is the notion of where does the buzz come from and how does it spread?
Right.
And that goes to my point about, I think increasingly, the word of mouth mm-hmm. is going to be so ubiquitous, so easily discoverable,
mm-hmm.
that will be the way that that part of the process
yep.
happens, or it'll be the way that that part of the process happens that is credible.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right? Now, the customer service issue that you've raised is, to my mind, separate, but you've made a fascinating point. And I absolutely agree with you. I'll give you a related example. In fact, a couple of weeks ago, I interviewed a guy called Paul English. He's the founder of Kayak.com. The way that I got in touch with him was that I wanted to talk to him about, he's the guy that started this thing called the IVR cheat sheet. I don't know if you know about this, but so IVR is interactive voice response. So
okay.
You know, basically phone menu systems. And he got really ticked off some years ago about how you can sort of never reach a human being when you
yeah.
try to call.
Right.
The hack that he did was he put up this little database of cheats. So it was like for American Express,
yeah.
you can blow past the menu tree if you push this button or if you say this word, right? And here's how you get, you know, get through at Apple. Here's how you get through at Citibank, right? You put it, and so this thing, it just mushroomed. It became wildly, it is still wildly popular, but about a year and a half ago, it was like a huge deal. So anyway, I was talking to him about this, and he's thinking all the time about customer service. And one of the things he told me is that they've made the engineers, the software engineers at Kayak, responsible for answering service calls and emails. The idea being that if some piece of user interaction on the site is creating a lot of questions, then making the developers field those questions is a surefire way to have them fundamentally streamline the process so that they don't get bugged with those questions anymore.
Right? Exactly.
So, which is you know, which is an important insight. But where I'm going with this is that these guys are doing lots of one-on-one with people, including Paul, right? He's like the CEO or the founder, but he said he's like the number one or number two question answerer in email. And I said, so why don't you blog your Q&A? He's like, wow, you know, I never thought about that, right?
Totally.
And so that would be an obvious thing to do because, you know, of course, there is going to be repetition and duplication. And so, you know, why wouldn't you do that? So that's another angle. But what you've suggested would indeed be the ideal thing.
Right.
If a company were sensitive enough to what was being said about it throughout the web and had the wherewithal to actually parachute in to the comments section where some complaint was aired and answer it right there, that would just be awesome.
Isn't that cool? Right. Yeah. And so in the architecture and just my world here, we see that as being the way to answer and give guidance to people who are already generating the conversation. So if you happen onto a blog and there is technology now that can kind of help you pull all those together. They're talking about something in the way of software as a service. You know, they have some question about, well, if I really wanted to implement a software as a service app and I had X kind of a setup, anybody know how you do that?
Mm-hmm.
It would be so powerful for us to go, hello, here we are.
Yes.
We know how to do that. We'd love to help you.
Yes.
You know?
Absolutely. That would be very cool. And beyond that, you would then be in a position to aggregate a bunch of that stuff back up into your into your site. That comes around to a question that I was going to ask you, but you've already sort of answered it. You know, my question to you would have been, apart from the stuff that you publish from your internal sources, you know, how much of the community conversation are you reflecting back out? So is that part of the plan too?
Yeah. So my plan is that we would be able to do that through kind of the technology that I talked about, and we would be able to push it back into the conversation where they're already living. So it's really about relevance, which is what everybody's trying to figure out now. People are already having the conversation, and they're already comfortable in the communities that are in, so that they are in.
Mm-hmm.
How can we push our content, not push our content, but, you know, help them with, that sounds so marketing.
Isn't it funny how, it's funny how hard it is to let go of certain linguistic habits.
Right. It sounds so not pretty, but help them with their conversation and where they're already living.
Yeah.
And we can do that. And we will do that in the second half of the year. And that's one of the initiatives that I want to drive, is to get where the conversation's already happening and help those people with the offerings that they may not know about. They may not be aware that we're offering guidance around whatever.
And I would also add that you would then be in a position to make connections across related domains. And so, for example, you mentioned that the patterns and practices stuff is really a different group within Microsoft, and you kind of don't mainly talk to those people and they don't mainly talk to you. But, you know, there are latent connections that do want to get surfaced when and where appropriate. To the extent that you could be bridging between these related domains, that would also be incredibly useful.
So can you think of a way, or what is the most appropriate way for you? Again, back to the, how can people contact bloggers and do it in a way that is respectful?
What do you mean by contact bloggers?
Okay, so if you have somebody blogging, let's just talk about Vista, only because everybody's talking about it today.
Okay.
So you've got Vista. Again, back to the scenario, you know that there's these 10, I'll just use 10 influential bloggers that you've been watching for a while because that's your business.
Right.
And they've been chatting about lots of stuff, but operating systems is one of the things that they chat about.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to be able to say to them, hey, check out our system. Let people know what you think of our system. Here's, you know, a way to try it. Here's a way to give your feedback through your blog, but we want you to check out our system and let people know what you think, because we feel like it's a pretty great system. And we want you to know, we want to participate in your conversation.
Yeah, so now we're into this realm where we're, you know, it's the opposite of the long tail. What is the opposite of the long tail? The short head? I don't know. Right.
The opposite of the long tail is everything we've been doing. I mean, the opposite of the long tail is what businesses have been doing historically.
Yeah.
Is going after the masses.
Hmm. Well, but through a very small number of presumably privileged channels to them.
Yes. Yes.
So my gut feeling, for what it's worth, is that it's... So I spent a long time in the trade press.
Mm-hmm.
And have been on the receiving end of many, many, many pitches mm-hmm. for coverage. And frankly, after a while, you just grow a really thick skin
mm-hmm.
and are pretty uninfluenced by those kinds of appeals.
Mm-hmm.
I did think about this a whole lot, and I wrote a series of things a while ago on my InfoWorld blog about what would be the appropriate way for someone to contact me about a technology that I didn't know about that I might want to look into.
Mm-hmm.
And what it boiled down to was, show me that there is somebody's blog who understands the product, is the inventor or is the implementer, and deeply understands the thing and is telling its story over time in a coherent and credible way on some blog. And just once, just contact me once and say, just wanted to point you at the blog of so-and-so, who's our chief technologist, who is really excited about this stuff for the following reasons, but it stops there, right? You know, either you go there or you don't. And
Okay. There's
a number of interesting properties to this arrangement, one of them being that it's actually not necessary now for the conventional protocol, which is, you know, call me back 2 days later, call me back 3 days later, mm-hmm. email me again. Did you get my email? Did you,
totally.
Right? Because it's,
yeah.
because think about it. Either I went there or I didn't. So you can see that, right? You can,
yep.
you see that in your logs. So you know if I even went there.
Right.
And then you know if I took that extra all important step of subscribing, which says,
yeah.
I actually was interested enough to want to hear what this person has to say until further notice.
Yeah.
Right? That's what I think is the right way.
So that is really interesting, John. If I can just rephrase so that as me, marketer, understands what you said, to turn it around a little bit and say, just using the Vista example, so if you do want to share your cool operating system or you want these influential bloggers to try your operating system, you're saying that Vista should have a blog and talk about all of this on their own. And at such a time that you want somebody to pay attention to what you're saying, it makes sense to reach out to whoever those influencers are that you want to pay attention to what you're saying, send them a ping one time.
Once.
One time on a particular day and say, hey, Bob, I see that you have a really interesting blog and you blog about technology, and I just wanted you to see my blog over here. I made a recent post about blah-de-blah. Love for you to check it out and be done.
Yep.
And that's what you think.
Yeah. Now, obviously, there wouldn't be one blog, or there is not one blog for something like Vista, right? But yeah, exactly, right? And
right. So
then the next piece of it was, what then is the role of the marketer or the PR professional, right? Have they in fact been disintermediated mm-hmm. by this process? And mm-hmm. the answer is, to some extent, yes.
Mm-hmm.
But my argument was, and still is, that a lot of the folks who are in a position to be the primary storytellers aren't necessarily the best storytellers,
mm-hmm.
right? Now, it's in their interest to get better at it because everyone in every profession and in every aspect of every profession mm-hmm. can benefit by being a better communicator.
Right.
So just because your chief technologist is writing a blog about why he thinks or she thinks the product is cool and exciting
mm-hmm.
doesn't mean that they're telling the story in the best possible way. So my notion was that what the role of the marketer or the PR person then becomes is communication coach.
Mm-hmm.
Because people understand software engineering and electrical mm-hmm. engineering. They don't necessarily understand rhetoric
mm-hmm.
very well.
Mm-hmm.
Although, again, it would serve their own personal interest if they mm-hmm. if they were better at it.
Right.
It's tricky, right? Because obviously there's going to be an incentive in this kind of a situation for blogs to be ghostwritten. Right. However, I claim that relatively few, if any, of the ones that I've been following are ghostwritten. And I think that the reason for that is that there's this way in which if someone is blogging over time, it becomes really hard to fake who that person is.
Yep.
Right? It's like there's this Turing test thing that happens, right?
Yep.
Yeah. And so that gets to this other notion that I've had for a while now, which is that What would the world be like if every professional person in every line of work saw it as part of their professional life to be not every day, maybe not even every week, maybe not even every month, but on some frequency to be articulating what I call their public agenda online? Because in effect, this is what happens anyway, right? And the fact of the matter is that all of our stories are being told somewhere online, if not by us, mm-hmm. right? Then they're being told about us. Mm-hmm. This is something I've been chewing on for a while now, but I really feel like we're entering an era where everyone should sort of own their public record.
So this has been really interesting.
This was fun, actually. Yeah,
good.
I like your idea a whole lot.
Good.
About kind of parachuting into to people's blogs and answering their questions and comments. Yep. And when you start to do that, I'd be really interested for you to point me to some good examples of it. I think it would be enlightening.
There's a company in Seattle called Visible Technologies.
Okay.
They have a tool that I'll be using to do that with, and their tool is in beta right now. I think it's available March 1st.
Mm-hmm.
So the month of February, and maybe it'd be interesting to talk in about 4 weeks, the month of February, we're going to be doing a crawl to really find out where the conversations are happening,
right.
So really getting a baseline, where are they talking, who's talking, and then that would be February, and then March we'll be able to start kind of doing what I was talking about, doing a real-time engagement of the places that we identified were having the conversations. Now let's go out and, you know, help these people move their conversations along.
And so what will the tool do for you that the existing suite of search and aggregation engines won't do?
Right, so what the tool will be able to do is, you have multiple people on the same tool, so I think you can buy as many ports as you want.
Mm-hmm.
So I can have all my architects have the tool on their site, and then it will, in the tool, focus for them which are the blogs that are, so it'll have the terms that we feed it. You teach the tool, as far as I understand it, you teach the tool through usage to get more defined into what you're looking for. So
okay.
The more we search and the more we use it,
okay.
The more it's going to get into what we actually are looking for our content specific to architecture.
Okay. So you could do all this stuff, quote unquote, by hand, but it's an automation.
It's an automated tool, and then it allows you to, right there, you feed all your accounts into it, so your blog account or whatever. You respond through the tool to that forum or to that blog or whatever. You respond
okay.
right through the tool.
So the idea is it also has encapsulated the comment forms and
yes.
protocols of a variety of different blogs and so on.
Yes.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah. Yeah. So we'll see.
Nice talking with you, Marty.
You too. Thanks a lot, Don.
Take care.
Okay, bye.